From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Despite the fact he hasn't been accepted by some of the believers, Jeff Chu says he can't not believe in God. Chu was raised in a devout evangelical family. We're talking Southern Baptist devout. And his belief was actually solidified during the years he was coming to terms with his sexuality and coming out. Not so long ago, he decided to make a pilgrimage. Not the kind where you go to a sacred shrine, but the kind where you go looking for enlightenment. And here's what he wanted to learn. He wanted to understand why all those who call themselves followers of Jesus Christ start from the same point and end up in different places when it comes to the church and homosexuality. Jeff Chu is in Salt Lake City this week. Today he's joining us to talk about his journey. His book is called Does Jesus Really Love Me? After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For some people, coming out as being gay marks the end of the relationship with or connection to God, the end of their religious life. For Jeff Chu, his belief was actually solidified during that painful time when he came to accept his sexuality and come out to his friends and family. Chu was raised in a devout evangelical family, and in his new book, Does Jesus Really Love Me?, he says he clung to God because he had to believe someone bigger and more powerful would someday make this all okay. The book is a chronicle of his journey, his pilgrimage, to explore the complicated relationship between faith and sexuality. Chu has traveled for thousands of miles. He visited 28 states, went to dozens of different churches, interviewed hundreds of people. He's in Salt Lake City this week, and he's joining us today to talk about his journey and what he found out about faith and God and people and about love. Jeff Chu says he found a country that deeply wants to love but is conflicted about just how. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jeff Chu is a journalist who has written for Time Magazine, for the Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company. Does Jesus Really Love Me? Is his first book. And Jeff Chu, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
I'm so glad to be here.
I guess I wanted to start with, really very basic question, but I guess I wanted to start with a question I'm sure you've gotten before. When did you really know you were gay? I mean, have you also always sensed it? I mean, when did you really know it?
The tough thing about that question is the language. So I think many of us knew we were gay as kids, but we wouldn't have called it that.
Yeah.
We knew we were different from other kids. We knew that our crushes were different from the ones that other folks had.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had crushes on other boys and I knew I wasn't supposed to talk about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until later that I had the language to explain that.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about this. You went to high school in at Westminster High School in Miami. And you talk about how a few months into the fall of your freshman year, Mr. Byers, whom you really liked, he taught a Bible class, stopped showing up to class. And then it was scandalous. They had this like class assembly where you all went in and it was announced that he had had a homosexual affair and that he was being let go. And you say that the thing that you remember most about that was the fear that swamped you. Talk about that, because that seems to have been a realization, a really frightening realization for you.
So Mr. Byers was the cool teacher.
Yeah.
I feel like every high school has that cool teacher who's younger than the other teachers, and you feel like you can relate to these teachers a little more. And during this chapel, I saw him basically being tarred and feathered, even though he wasn't there in person.
Yeah.
And this was the first time in my life where I felt like someone was telling me, this is who you are. This is how to articulate the feelings that you have. And if you go public, or if you're found out like Mr. Byers was, the same thing is going to happen to you. It may not be that you lose your teaching job because you're not a teacher,
yeah,
but you'll be kicked out of your church. You'll be kicked out of your family.
These are the consequences for going public.
Exactly.
And so you thought about that, what? That, okay, I feel this way, so then I'm just going to have to keep it quiet. Is that the conclusion you came to, sort of?
My conclusion was I have to keep it not just keep it quiet, but try to live another way.
Yeah.
So when I got to college, I had girlfriends. who I met in my Bible study. And when you're a conservative Christian, it's very easy to be chaste because that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to worry too much about the temptation because we're good Christian kids. We don't do that kind of thing anyway. So in some ways, the framework was there for a very easy closet. The framework was there for me to maintain the facade of being straight, even though deep down I knew I wasn't.
You know, I had a conversation years ago with a gay Mormon. This was actually on the campus of Brigham Young University. And I remember him saying that to him, he was trying to fit. It was even more difficult in those days. This was, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And he was trying to find his way to fit within the constraints of Mormonism and still be true to some degree to himself. And I asked him why he just didn't leave. Like, why not just go? I mean, you're not really welcome there, not really. And he said the part of him that was gay, his sort of sexual core, wasn't any stronger than what he saw as his spiritual core, his relationship with God. I'm wondering, does that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely it resonates. I think for many of us who grew up in these more conservative parts of Christianity, where it's not just a Sunday thing, but it's the culture. It's the way your family lives. It's what ties your experience together. It's hard to be forced to make that choice between faith and sexuality. And I've gotten in trouble with some people for saying faith is as much a part of me and who I am as my sexuality is. A lot of people don't like to hear that. But for me, these are two core aspects of my being. And it just doesn't feel right for other people who don't know me in my soul to say, you have to pick one or the other.
You know, I wanted you to ask you about a review of the book that was written by the gay rights activist Dan Savage. He liked the book a lot. He thinks it's really important. But he did wonder if you were being, as he said, not so generous to those who are no longer believers. I wonder how you responded to that. The idea that, as he says, as he saw it anyway, you kind of bemoan the decline of belief for some gay people and dedicate the book to those who have endured. And I guess his sense is that you're somehow undermining those who figured, you know, I can't endure, or I don't believe. This is not meshing with my sense of. How do you respond to that?
Dan made clear in his review that he walked out of the church. That was his experience. For most of the people I interviewed, they were pushed out of the church. And I think you have to make a distinction between those two things. I feel awful that some of the men and women I interviewed have had their faith in some sense taken away from them. And that's what I was thinking about when I dedicated my book to those who have endured. I don't mean endured necessarily in the kind of faith I grew up with, but I mean endured in life, because life is hard and things are complex when you're talking about sexuality and religion. So I think he was jumping to a conclusion about what I meant by endurance, actually, because endurance is going to look like different things for different people.
There's a chapter later in the book, but I wanted to get to this because it gives me a sense of your family's religion, your grandfather's faith. I suppose it was your grandfather who first came to Christianity?
On one side of the family, it was my great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather.
Who became a missionary. He found Jesus, he would say, at the Salvation Army in Hong Kong, and after that he became a missionary.
You write about your grandfather's three-ring binder. That contains his sermons. And you say that when you spend time with those words, you always think solitude. Explain what you mean. Because you say even though your grandfather had 60 years of marriage to your grandmother, and even though he had 5 kids, and even though he had grandkids, you say his life was one of remarkable aloneness.
I think to be a leader in a spiritual community, like a pastor, like a bishop, is at once the most social job you could have and the most antisocial. Because it's an incredible burden to carry, to have people coming to you all the time with the problems of their lives, especially when you know you have 5 kids, not a lot of money coming in, and your own problems. And then who do you go to? So when I reflect on my grandfather's life, he was such in my mind and in my memory, a great and faithful servant of God, I do sometimes wonder how hard it was for him in its own way to serve in the way that he did and to live in the way that he did.
It's so interesting, too, because you're so this is so embedded in the DNA of your family, really, this idea of belief, this idea of devotion. When you came out to your parents, it's fair to say they didn't take it so well. They still haven't taken it so well. But you didn't, but you put that reaction, and even still you put that reaction in a kind of a deep, loving context. Explain how you are, and it's not you justifying their, I don't think. I think it's you're trying to understand it, it seems. And this is I think, and we'll get to this idea, because it seems like the book is so much about this idea of how to understand love and how we define that and how we come to it. But you put their response to it, which some would say is not abandoning you. I mean, they didn't come to you. When you got married last September, your aunt came, one of them, but no one else really did from your family. And I'm sure you're disturbed by that, but in some ways also you're putting it, again, in a different context. Explain that, if you would.
This is the world I grew up in. Yeah. I speak the language of conservative Christianity, and I know their hearts. There are different kinds of love, right? Parents will sometimes say, I need to react with a tough love. I see that's what my parents are trying to do. My mother doesn't want me to go to hell. That is a loving thing for a mother to not want her son to go to hell. And she feels that my sexuality could send me to hell. Yeah. I get that. And I have to honor that even if I disagree with that. It's not going to do anything for my relationship going forward with my mom and for my husband's relationship going forward with my mom if I'm strident and angry and walk away from her. If I walk away, it will confirm every stereotype that she wants in some sense to believe, that as a gay person, I am rebelling against what God wants, that I'm a bad son. I try my best to be a good son to show her I'm the same person I was before I told her I was gay.
You say that getting back to love more broadly, again, we'll get more particular as we go, but you say, as I said in the introduction, you found a country that deeply wants to love but is not sure about how. What do you mean by that? We want to do the right thing. We want to believe, but we feel like we're conflicted by our sense of spirituality. We're not sure if we should moderate that tough love with all-encompassing, unconditional love. Is that what you're getting at?
There's a lot of confusion. Love means different things to different people. Yeah. So, for instance, when I was at Westboro Baptist Church, the God Hates Fags Church in Kansas, which most people would agree is probably the most hateful congregation that they know of in America— one of the most difficult things for me to accept, but something that I came to understand in my 5 days there, was that most of the people in that church are loving people. They believe we're all going to hell, anybody who's not a member of that church. They said to me, what kind of neighbors would we be to you if we saw you going down this path and we didn't warn you to turn around? If your car is driving off a cliff, what kind of people would we be if we didn't try to stop you? So in their minds, all this destructive, offensive language is their act of love. We don't feel it that way, right? Yeah. We react to it as if they're words of hate because that's how they sound to us. And from a marketing perspective, you can ask a very fair question, which is, if the people don't get what you're trying to say, maybe your marketing is a little off. But when you look at the motive is there. They do, for the most part, there are exceptions, they do, for the most part, want to love. And likewise, on the liberal end of the spectrum, the people who tell me just to ditch God, to get rid of this mumbo jumbo, they want me to be happier. Yeah. I see that in the emails that I've gotten in reaction to this book. They want me to be grounded and resolved. And their gesture of love is saying to me, ditch all this stuff that's weighing you down.
The Westboro Baptist Church experience was, you must have felt, I mean, you write about this, how your friends were saying, Jeff, don't even justify them with any kind of ink. They're nothing but hateful. And you felt conflicted about that yourself. Why did you decide that I'm going to go ahead and write about it? Because I'm not sure I know you are glad you wrote about it, I guess, but you still must feel somewhat conflicted about all of that.
I am still conflicted because they thrive on publicity. This is their game. 40 people in the middle of Kansas, they need people like me to help them amplify their message. There are two reasons I really ended up writing about them. One is that they're disproportionately influential in American life. That a 40-person band of believers gets so much coverage in the newspapers has won a case at the Supreme Court that allows them to picket military funerals. As a journalist, I felt like I had to get to the bottom of why they believe what they believe. And I realized when I was there that what we read in the papers is a caricature. There are so many reasons to oppose Westboro. I want us to oppose them for the right and most informed reasons. The second reason I wanted to write about Westboro is that it's actually not that far from other parts of conservative Christianity. For instance, they're constantly telling us God hates you. There's a church in Seattle, a conservative evangelical church with 10,000 people each Sunday, where the pastor, Mark Driscoll, has preached almost exactly the same thing in a sermon. It's very easy for us to dismiss Westboro as the lunatic fringe. Yeah. It's more uncomfortable, but I think more necessary for us to engage them and realize, okay, they're not as fringe and as lunatic as we think they are.
You say most Christians, or most religious people anyway, have spiritual wedge issues. We all have these kinds of issues. It just so happens that yours is homosexuality. That's your spiritual wedge issue. But we all have them. We all are working through, you say, some kind of, those who believe anyway, some kind of, and it seems like the book is a lot about this, reconciling this idea of what we mean by God. What we mean by how he relates. Again, that tough love versus unconditional love. We're all working through these, at least believers, you say.
I think one of the tough things that I've seen a lot as I've been traveling around the country is when we mistake God and the people of God. So we sit in church and we hear things that other people say to us, whether gossip or some offhand comment that someone makes, and we end up tarring all of it with a big brush. And it kind of does a disservice to God to let that bad PR from the people in the pews affect how we view him. I think for some of us, our spiritual wedge issues are things like the role of women in church, or how divorce is handled, or even how a pastor or a bishop has treated someone in our family in a way that we think is unjust.
Yeah.
It can be a small thing, it can be a big thing, but these can all mushroom into things that drive wedges between us and God. Mm. And I think it's so important to be able to differentiate between church and God.
So in that sense, homosexuality is kind of almost beside the point. It's just another one of those things that you're working out in your relationship with God.
I think I would get in a lot of trouble with a lot of pastors if I said it was beside the point. But I understand what you're saying, and I do agree with you. It's in some sense symbolic of a lot of other issues. It's just more of a flashpoint issue, especially at this point in time in the country.
Yeah. So you decided to go on this pilgrimage. You decided to go on this journey. Did you distill down exactly what it was you wanted to learn, like what the questions were you wanted to kind of pose or at least get at?
The core of it was really to understand why we start with the same scripture, the same God, the same Jesus, and yet the Episcopal Church looks so vastly different in how they treat gay people from Westboro. And there's so many different kinds of Presbyterians. Mm-hmm. And how do they use the same brand name? And yet in one church, it's okay to show up with your husband. And in another church, the only people who can have husbands are women. So it was very confusing to me how it could even be one religion.
We'll get to what you learned, of course, as we go along. Jeff Chu is with us. He is the author of Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. You can get details by calling the store at 801-484-9100 or just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Jeff Chu is our guest. He's written a book that is getting a lot of attention lately. Chu was raised in a devout evangelical family, and so when he told his parents he was gay, they were crushed. Chu wanted to understand and explore the complicated relationship between faith and sexuality. So he went around the country interviewing the faithful, evangelicals who are straight and gay, even those who find themselves somewhere in between. His book is a story of the people who want to love but aren't sure quite how. At the heart of it is this question, which is also the title, Does Jesus Really Love Me? He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight. We'll give you the details about that. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. There's a section in the book, Jeff Chu, where you talk about this question of choosing celibacy. And you spoke with a gay man named Wesley Hill, who had published this book that you mentioned had kind of become this minor sensation among Christians, because he seemed to have found kind of this middle ground in some way for religious people, you know, agreeing that homosexuality isn't a choice, but still saying homosexual behavior is bad, is sinful. Hill acknowledges that he was born gay, but he sees it as a disordered sexuality. That's how he puts it. And so he concedes that there is a certain kind of loneliness that he's going to have to go through if he's going to remain faithful to God, which of course means living a celibate life. Talk about Wesley Hill, and we're going to talk about another character as we go, but just this idea is, because this seems like this is, I'm not sure if it's a trend within Christianity, but a lot of people are sort of coming here saying, all right, okay, homosexuality isn't a choice, but the behavior is bad, is a sin.
It's a comfortable third way for a lot of conservative Christians who believe that gay and lesbian people have been poorly treated by the church. The first step is to acknowledge that it's not a choice, and a lot of people can agree on that now. But then what do you do?
Right.
And many people still cannot accept that a homosexual relationship is valid in the eyes of God and approved of by the people of God. Wes is such a thoughtful guy. He teaches theology now, and he chronicled his journey in this book, Washed and Waiting, in which he explores the theology of celibacy and of sexuality, seeking to understand how he can at once be an acknowledged gay man, but make choices that he believes are honoring to his reading of the Bible. What I appreciate is that he doesn't try to force that reading on anyone else.
Yeah.
And I think celibacy will never work if it's forced on someone. It has to be a choice. It's hard enough, a concept and a life as it is, even if you're the one who chooses that. But to have it forced on someone, it's never going to work. And I think parents of gay people need to understand that. You can't badger your kid into a successful and satisfying life of celibacy. It's not going to work.
So you kind of go out and test the theory for someone who has chosen this life. And there are, of course, people out there. You found one in a 57-year-old man named Kevin Olson. And you wanted to know. I mean, here are the questions you were getting at. And I want to talk about whether what you learned about that. But you wanted to know how for someone, I mean, it was one thing for Wesley, who's a young guy now, to say, all right, we could choose that. But what if there was someone out there who had, in fact, made this choice and had done it over a prolonged amount of time? That's Kevin Olson. He had actually done that. And you wanted to know, all right, what are the consequences of that? What has he learned from that? How has he been able to do that? Talk about Kevin Olson.
The short version is it's been really, really hard. He made a choice 30 years ago to live a life of celibacy. He knew he would never get married. He knew he would always be alone at those big moments in life. He would never have a wedding of his own. He knew that the space in bed next to him would always be empty. His life has only been fulfilling in his view because he's focusing on what comes next. He's focusing on heaven. He's focusing on this afterlife that many people don't believe in.
Yeah.
So he lives in hope of another life, a better life, when he feels like he will be redeemed by the God that he believes in. That's all he has to go on. And that's really hard. That's not something that I think many people can do ultimately.
How does he explain his condition? I'll put that in air quotes. How does he explain, it's as if, how does he explain that God would somehow have afflicted him with this thing? How does he explain God in that way?
I don't believe that he sees this as something God has put into him. His view is that there are a lot of bad things in the world. This is a fallen, broken world. And it just so happens that in his life, it manifested in homosexuality. I pushed him a little bit on this question, and he was clearly a little bit uncomfortable dwelling too much because there's no clear answer. We don't know why people are gay. I don't know why I'm gay. He speculated it might have had for him to do with his distant relationship with his dad, who is actually still living. But he doesn't know. And so ultimately—
These are the tropes you hear time and time again. Weird relationship with your mom, weird relationship with your dad.
I also met a lot of gay guys who have great relationships with
their
parents. So then what do you do?
Yes.
In Kevin's case, he believes it's unwise to dwell too much on the why because it's not helping him figure out what to do next. It's very retrospective.
Yes.
And it's a tough enough thing day after day to focus on fighting the temptation to find someone, on focusing on God, on reading the scriptures. And I have great admiration for him, even though I haven't made the same choices, because he has chosen such a tough path. And I think we have to, when we're looking at these people's lives, we have to have that sort of empathy. I worry sometimes that we have a national skill shortage in empathy, in seeing why people have made the choices that we make. We don't have to agree with them, but we have to soften our hearts enough to understand why they made them.
This seems like this in some ways is the spiritual challenge for you. Because you say you came away with your experience with Kevin Olsen, not with pity, but humbled. So you were able to muster that sense of empathy for Kevin and others. But I imagine there had to have been moments when you felt, not disgusted, but like he was such a pitiful creature.
There were definitely moments. And I think that's one of the worst things that you can feel for another human being is pity, because it's so demeaning and it's so degrading and it puts you above that person. You elevate yourself onto this pedestal. Kevin has made choices. He is a smart, caring, thoughtful guy. He's made his own choices, and we need to respect that on some level. Can you say he's been brainwashed? Can you say he's bought into Christian propaganda? Some people might say that, but we're talking about faith, and at a certain point, faith is not a logical thing.
Yeah.
I can't be argued out of believing in God, just like I can't argue an atheist into believing in God. And I think sometimes these conversations break down because we get to that point where we realize they're not logical. They can't be.
He believes that celibacy has not been, as you put it in the book, an act of fencing himself off. Rather, it has been one of opening up, of embracing the sanctuary that he believes his Lord provides. And that is that I guess that until the time comes when he'll be, I don't know, cured or whatever, he has to walk a solitary life. And there's something that's kind of beautiful about that, but there's something that seems so sad about that too.
For those of us who have found people we want to spend the rest of our lives with, who have built families, it seems hard. But there are plenty of examples of people in the Bible who lead solitary lives and devote themselves to God. There was a funny moment after I told my mother that I was gay where she said, "Maybe you're blessed like Paul." And I had to write to her and say, "I don't think I'm blessed like Paul, the Apostle Paul. I mean, I'm not Paul." But she was just hoping that maybe God had planted that seed in me where I could just devote myself to scripture and study and prayer and not feel the need for a romantic relationship.
It's interesting, though. You also say, look, there are plenty of solitary creatures in nature. The starfish and the Tasmanian devil and the black rhino. But you humans, you point out, are not on that list. And you refer to the Bible, Genesis, where it says it is not good for man to be alone. This is not our natural state. At least that's where you are, right?
I take the Bible really seriously. I think sometimes people make the mistake of seeing a gay person and they think, oh, they've dispensed with scripture. But I love the Bible. It's a magnificent book with both spiritual and literary value. And you look at the beginning of the story as God has presented it to us, and man is not alone. What does that mean? Of course, we can interpret the Bible any number of ways, and we have. There are theologians across the spectrum who would quibble with the way that I have interpreted it. Fortunately, I'm not a theologian. I'm a journalist, and so I chose to travel around the country and find the ways in which we've tried to live out the stories as opposed to arguing about things that were written a long time ago.
It did make me wonder if you thought that. There's the section from Washington Waiting that you refer to where Hill describes experiencing God's love and how this yearning and blessing must, and this is how he puts it, must spell the end of longing and loneliness for the homosexual Christian, which means that, what, you sublimate your homosexual love for the love of Christ, which made me wonder, I wonder if Jeff is ever wondering if his, and you kind of put it this way in some way, if your desire for God is too small. You're left wanting, Jeff, because you are not able to sublimate that homosexual love for that love of God. You've chosen the human one.
Did one of my pastors send you here to ask me these questions? I wonder that sometimes. Yeah. Sure. I will be fully honest and say there are days where I feel fully embraced by God and I love Jesus more than anything. And there are days when I wonder whether God exists. I wish more of us would be more candid about those spiritual ups and downs, because living with faith is not just this cakewalk where every day the sun shines and Jesus is wrapping his arms around you. Yeah. It's hard. A lot of bad things happen in life that challenge that structure that you can't see and can't prove. So if you ask me today, I might say, I'm feeling pretty good about my faith. Ask me tomorrow and it's cloudy and the prognosis is not good.
And this is the process. It doesn't ever resolve, right? It's always a question, I suppose.
I hope someday it'll resolve, but who knows? We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Here's an email from Bryce who writes, I am a gay man that was raised in a Mormon household and in a Mormon community. He asks, how do you commingle the fact that you're gay, but seemingly every interpretation of Christian doctrine says homosexuality is against God's will? Bryce also wants to know what kind of advice you give those of us who are gay who have grown resentful of religion, in particular the Christian religion. Let's start with that idea that how is it that you reconcile, because this is where a lot of Christians are right now. How do I explain what God says in Leviticus, what God is referred to in Paul, you know, the writings of Paul? How do I reconcile that with you know, who I am and what I believe?
There are many people much more learned than I am who have delved into these scriptures in their original languages, because we have to remember that what we read in English isn't how it was originally delivered. Yeah. And they've come to very different conclusions about these very same scriptures. There are very godly and learned people who have come to more liberal interpretations and some who have come to more conservative ones. So I feel like each person has to read those interpretations for themselves and decide for himself or herself whether those are legit, whether they pass muster, whether they feel right in your heart and soul. As far as the scar tissue that's built up because of all the wounds that churches inflict on people who are gay and lesbian, I try to, on my better days, I try to cling to the idea of grace, because I have felt a certain amount of grace from a lot of friends and family in my life who have been there to walk alongside me and to support me. My mother's spiritual struggle looks different from mine, but it's still a spiritual struggle. And I feel like the biggest gift I can give to her is the grace to allow her to walk that struggle and have me be there with her. It doesn't do either of us any good for the other to walk away. We don't always understand why we differ on these issues, but I do feel like her heart is pursuing something that's pure and good. Her heart wants to do the right thing, and I hope she gets that my heart wants to do the right thing too.
Jeff Chu is with us. He's the author of the book, Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight at 7 o'clock. You can get details by going to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, or call the store. It's 801-484-9100. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Jeff Chu. We're talking about his book, Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. There's a section where you talk about this idea of agreeing to disagree. Let's talk about Andrew Freeman. The day that he was consecrated as a missionary for the Evangelical Covenant Church is the day he comes out to his parents. And you describe the Evangelical Covenant Church as kind of as a test of this idea of just how big is the tent, or the tent meeting anyway, of the church going to be? How much can the church bear? Can we agree to disagree? Let's start with Andrew Freeman.
Andrew was such a fascinating guy for me because he very openly and candidly wrestled with his calling to service in the church as well as his sexuality. Yeah. Andrew, after coming out, went on to create a space online called Coming Out Covenant, where members of his denomination shared their stories. And this was such an important step for them, no matter where they were on this issue, to be able to share their stories, not just as gay people, but as parents of gay people, as siblings of gay people, as bystanders and friends. Because I think one thing that we don't often do in church enough is wrestle together with some of these difficult issues. What actually has to be a deal breaker? That's something that his denomination has thought a lot about over the years. Does someone need to be baptized when they're babies, or can they be baptized as adults? Can women be ordained, or can we agree to disagree and have some congregations ordain women while others feel like that's not something we're comfortable with, but we respect the right of other people to do that? Can we all be so gracious? And I think some of those questions apply in the political arena beyond the church, because I know not everybody in America is Christian and not everybody gets why the issues in my book are so salient. Can we as a country agree to disagree about some of these things? And I'm not sure that we say yes very often.
You know, you write about this idea of unity. That's a big theme in the book. You write about how, as a Protestant, you know, every church, pretty much every church that you ever attended, you say, was the product of not just one split, but all kinds of different splits. And in fact, you say the history of Christianity is a history of rivalries and rifts. Paul, as you mentioned, admonishing Christians to stop fighting, let's get along. And you say this, you say, we live in a time of ecclesiastical and denominational divorce, and issues related to sexuality are a big catalyst in that process. Talk about unity, this idea of unity, because it seems to be one of those questions still up in the air. Can Christianity forge this sense of unity on this issue and other issues?
On my more cynical days, I feel like that fight is over. It's been lost. In America, there are more than 2,000 Christian denominations. And we get more and more non-denominational churches every day. We're not counting those little outposts or those mega churches that don't belong to any denomination. So you add those in, and I don't know how many thousands you have. In some sense, the unity's gone. But can we claw back to a position where we can say with some confidence that Christians, those people who call themselves followers of Jesus, actually worship the same God? Some days I really hope so. Some days I look at the different Jesuses that I saw as I was traveling around the country, and I think, I just don't think we're going to be able to do it because the Episcopal Jesus looks so different from the Metropolitan Community Church Jesus, who looks so different from the LDS Jesus, who looks so different from the Baptist Jesus. And where does that leave us?
You say we've Hinduized Christianity. We've created these separate, different gods. It's one Jesus, supposedly. But that's not at all where it is in American religious life, at least Christian religious
life. My Bible teachers will say it's blasphemy to put the word Hindu in the same sentence as the name Jesus. But I really do think that the Hindus and the way they have this concept of God that manifests himself or herself in so many different multitudes of ways. If you look at the way we depict Jesus now, it's kind of like that.
There is you write about this young man of the Gay Christian Network, a guy by the name of Justin Lee. And this is interesting because Justin is going around having these debates, I guess, or these discussions around the country, I suppose. He goes to Georgia State, for example, two nights that you write about in your book. And Justin says that he wants to transform the conversation, and by that he means that Christians need to move beyond conversations where they're asking, we need to be more loving. Explain what Justin is getting at. He's saying we need to stop saying, all right, let's just be more loving. We want to move the conversation. But what's he getting at? What does he mean by that?
I believe what Justin means, and he's one of the most gracious, compassionate people I've ever met, and he puts me to shame in that department. I believe what he means is we're having a very superficial conversation. Everybody can just spout the words that we learned in Sunday school. Jesus loves me. I want to love you. Love thy neighbor. He wants us to have a more profound conversation.
Yeah.
What I saw him do at Georgia State was fascinating. There were people from a conservative Christian Bible study group, and there were people from the Gay Student Alliance. And he put them together in a room, and he asked them leading questions that would help shed light on the other. And what ended up happening was some of the Christian students said, I never really understood what someone's sexuality meant as part of their identity. And some of the gay students said, I never really understood how deeply Christians feel faith as part of their identity. And he's gradually chipping away at these walls, these artificial walls that we've put up. He's chipping away at the stereotypes because it's much harder to demonize a person that you know. It's much harder to write someone off in any sphere when you know their story, you know their family, you know their background, you know their motives. And he's done a remarkable job of that work.
You focus on the evangelical Christianity, obviously. But I'm wondering, being that you are in Utah now, what do you know about this, about the Mormon struggle for this question? There's a man who's not unlike Justin Lee. His name's Kendall Wilcox, who's going through the same experience trying to, as a gay man, trying to live in some ways, I guess, like Kevin Olsen, a celibate, at least for now, yet still trying to get the Mormon community together with the gay community, Orthodox Mormons with more liberal Mormons together, trying to have this kind of conversation. Are you seeing the same elements playing out in Mormonism as you are in evangelical Christianity?
I think the LDS experience is very similar to a lot of the rest of conservative Christianity. You see this tension. You see a lot of thinking about how we talk both about and to gay people. You see a lot of families realizing that this isn't someone else's problem. This is our problem.
Yeah.
And you see parents struggling to figure out how best to love their kids and love their God, both simultaneously and faithfully. I think we need more conversation. I think there is a tendency both in the part of the church that I come from as well as what I know of the LDS that we don't want to talk about these things. We have these facades, these polite, wonderful public images because we want to protect our witness, right? But what kind of witness are we providing to the people within the church, the gay man or the lesbian woman who's struggling to hang on to some sort of faith, who feels that he or she can't be open about what's going on in her heart and soul? So the witness isn't just outward, but there's an inward witness that's important too. And I think sometimes the church forgets about that. It forgets about the care for those hearts and souls who are already among us.
You know, Mormonism comes up in an interesting way in the book. You mentioned this Bishop Thad Barnum of the Anglican Mission of the Americas, and he's an Episcopal bishop of the splinter church. It's opposed to changes because of policies that are liberal related in some ways to sexuality is a big one. And he says liberal theologians are not trying to make scripture fit with – he's glad about this. He says, you know, liberal theologians aren't now trying to sort of make their sense of homosexuality or gay rights or whatever fit within scripture. He says what they're doing, and he likes this, even though he doesn't agree, is that they are, he says, God, that what they're saying is God has changed his mind on the matter. And he says, this is new gospel. And then he says something that caught my eye because we're here in Utah. He says, that's like Mormonism. And he says, I'm thankful for that argument. He doesn't agree with it. He said, liberal theologians like Mormons are saying, no, God's more fluid than that. We don't have to be bound by the Bible. We can say God is evolving, or God has maybe even changed his mind on that matter, which is really interesting.
A lot of Christians don't think the Book of Mormon, for instance, is canonical.
Exactly.
It's added, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily relevant on these issues. I think it's relevant if you like to talk about theological things and like to spend hours late at night diving into these big books with big words that I don't understand. But when it comes to individual experience, which is where I am concerned most and which is where I spend most of my storytelling time, I think some of these theological arguments are irrelevant. We don't really think about all the big books that are stacked up on the bookshelf. We think about the heart and about the spirit and the soul and desire and what are the right desires to have and how do we construct holy relationships? What does that mean to you? What does that mean to me? And how do we fit into each other's stories?
You know, going back to Justin, his efforts to try to get groups together to find that sort of less charged center, because that's, you say, where he kept pushing people. It seems in some ways that it's going to always end, Jeff, in an impasse. I mean, if you're determined to take the Bible literally, you know, if you're determined to see God's mind as unchanging, or if you believe that the humans who wrote the Bible had a perfect interpretation of God's mind, it seems like at some point you're going to be stuck. You're going to find this kind of impasse. But do you think that's the case? Do you think there's going to be a way beyond it? Or you just set aside the impasse and, as you said, find a way to love?
I don't see it as an impasse if I get to know your point of view better. Hmm. If I understand your story, Doug's story, a little more intimately, and I can be more gracious about your journey, that's progress for me. I'm not saying I have to convince you to agree with me on everything. And I think sometimes that's why I'm bored with politics, the way it's done in our country sometimes, because it's so black and white. But there's such depth and such struggle in our individual stories. So if we can get to a place where we're listening a little better, let's take those baby steps and not worry about the impasse part of it. We'll deal with that when we get there.
I wonder about one thing. You have this email pen pal, Gideon, this running email relationship that's included in the book. And this actually turned out to be the last trip of your journey. This was in Kingman, Arizona. And you say that Gideon says he hasn't changed throughout the process, but you say that's not true. He's changed through all of this. You say that Gideon's openness, his eagerly curious spirit, that's what you want for yourself, which brought the question to me, how have you changed through this process, through that process of the pilgrimage?
Being exposed to so many different points of view and the richness of people's journeys has been such a gift to me. I've sat in living rooms with people who have had tears pouring down their faces saying, thank you for asking me for my story nobody has ever asked before. Right. And I realized nobody asked me for my story either. I'm just foisting it on the world. But so many people have lessons. These are ordinary, allegedly ordinary people. And we are missing tapping this great resource of heart and soul and mind because sometimes we focus too much on hierarchies and what the power structure is telling us to do. So I learned a lot about that. I learned a lot about how extraordinary people are. I learned about how much work there is to do in terms of helping people have better conversations. That's not a question of Christian or non-Christian. I just feel like we can have more gracious conversations with people who disagree with us.
To the question of whether Jesus loves you, in some ways you come around to this idea that it kind of depends on who you ask, you say. And you say that you understand love differently now. You used to see it, you say, as a private love. Now you say you see it as something that's not to be kept private, but something that you need to share.
So my great-grandfather was the missionary, and I always like to think that that skipped a few generations and I could just do my journalistic thing and not have to do what he did. I don't think my calling is to spread the gospel in the way that my great-grandfather did or that my grandfather did even. But I do feel called to use my journalism in a way that I think builds people up and opens doors rather than closes them. We've done a lot of closing doors with the stridency and the anger that we have around issues like this. I know people have been hurt. I have been hurt. So many of us have built up what I said earlier was scar tissue. Yeah. I'm angry inside. There's a part of me that's raging with anger about injustice and about misperceptions of stereotypes and the way we are not treated as equals because of one element of our identity. But we need to be able to set some of those things aside. And so if I am a missionary for anything, it would be for a message that we can have kind and gracious conversations. We don't have to destroy our relationships because we disagree on this.
About 30 seconds left. You say that if change comes, it will come by small measures. You mentioned, for example, in a piece that you wrote last March that your mom hadn't visited you since 2007. I won't ask you about that, but I want to go back to that idea of small measures. You just sort of take it baby steps, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
Baby steps. And for my mom, the baby step is she's coming to visit in August. And that's awesome. Will we argue while she's at my house? Probably.
Yeah.
But I'm so grateful for her making that step to come. And my husband and I will do everything we can to make her as comfortable as she can be.
Jeff Chu. His book is Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight at 7 o'clock. Go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. Jeff Chu, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Ferguson.